The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Florence Nash from Triangle Radio Reading Service, and for the next half hour, I'll be reading to you mainly, I think, from the October issue of the AARP Bulletin. Our programming today is generously underwritten by Saliba Chiropractic. Saliba Chiropractic welcomes the geriatric community with any neck, back, or hip issues. You can call them at 919-782-4733. That's 919-782-4733. First of all, in the bulletin under Your Money, we've got an article, Left Alone and at a Loss. After her spouse's death, grief is magnified by tough financial questions they had failed to discuss. This is by Leslie Milk. It happened again recently. I upgraded the operating system on my computer and suddenly couldn't connect to my home's Wi-Fi account. It was in my name, but my late husband Benjamin had set it up and created the password. Benjamin and I were married for 46 years. He died 4 years ago after a harrowing battle with brain cancer. Ever since, I have been both missing him and missing clues that would unlock the secrets of our digital and financial lives. I was newly bereaved when I was first locked out of one of our joint accounts, our home email. I contacted the email provider. The conversation did not go well. How can I help you, Mr. B. Milk? I am not Mr. B. Milk. I am his widow. He died, and I can't get into our email account. So sorry for your loss, Mr. B. Milk. No, I am not Mr. B. Milk. He died. Can you answer your secret question, Mr. B. Milk, and then we can access your account? What was the first school you attended? Somehow, in all our years together, that had never come up. I took a guess. Wrong. Eventually, I had to hire an online computer firm that for $149 scrubbed my iMac. I got a new password, a new secret question, and was able to get back into our email. Benjamin and I shared a life, but I soon learned that we didn't share everything. We talked about major expenditures, but there were dozens of little things concerning our finances that we never discussed. Confronting the paperwork and bureaucracy precipitated by the death of a spouse, I was overwhelmed by the unexpected complications. Benjamin's illness hit us like a lightning strike. At age 75, he seemed remarkably healthy, with a slim, boyish body and a head of silver hair that friends envied. He was chairing a meeting of our condo board in suburban Maryland when he noticed that he was having trouble finding words, and his right hand was trembling. That night, the trembling continued. I thought he was having a stroke and called 911. He passed the EMT's stroke test, but we went to the nearby hospital emergency room just in case. Our daughter Meredith, a special education teacher, met us at the hospital. A CT scan revealed a small mass in his brain. Our son Jeremy arrived the next day from California. Benjamin apologized for messing up everybody's weekend. 10 days later, Benjamin was diagnosed with one of the most deadly forms of brain cancer, glioblastoma multiforme. While dealing with treatment, he tried valiantly to get his papers in order. He even pulled together all of his passwords, a dozen different combinations of letters and numbers, and put them in an email in that joint account. But he never told me what the email was called. After he died, I spent weeks combing through our online inbox looking for the mystery message. He didn't make it easy. Bad guys trolling would never have found it. I read message after message until I found the passwords in a file labeled numbers.rev. I never did find the answers to his secret questions, his first pet, his childhood best friend, the first street where he lived. I've had to ask his brother, and I've had to remember to tell my children the answers to mine. Looking back, I divide my ignorance into two categories: things I should have known and things I couldn't have known. I should have known the whereabouts of the documents for what we owned. Like many couples, we thought we had lots of time to arrange our affairs. At a time when it was all I could do to get dressed in the morning, it was hard to hunt for bank records, deeds, insurance policies, and investment records, let alone the passwords and secret questions that are the open sesame to assets. One of my first tasks as a widow was to file Benjamin's will at the county courthouse. Our will was so old that it contained provisions for guardianship of our children, who are now grown-ups and have children of their own. As I expected, we had named each other as beneficiaries of our IRAs and shared ownership of our home. But I didn't realize that my husband had one small investment account without a beneficiary. Because his account totaled less than $50,000, it was considered a small estate under Maryland law and probated quickly. As part of the probate process, the estate was advertised in the local paper. Within days, I received a call from a man claiming to be from a Delaware law firm representing Benjamin's creditors. I told him to put his claim in writing, and I never heard from him again. I've since learned that some unscrupulous people check obituaries and immediately apply for credit cards in the name of the deceased. Luckily, my son had notified the three major credit agencies right after Benjamin died, so nobody could claim his identity. That was just the beginning of dealing with death duties. The conventional wisdom to grieving spouses is to not make major decisions for a year. What they don't tell you is you'll be too busy dealing with minor ones. Benjamin didn't have life insurance, but he did have an IRA, an investment portfolio, Social Security benefits, Medicare, a Medicare supplemental insurance policy, and that small secret investment account. Notifying each government agency and financial institution required a raft of phone calls, notarized forms, and multiple meetings. No wonder I was advised to request at least a dozen original death certificates with raised seals. If Benjamin and I had been better organized, I might have been spared some of the unpleasant surprises, but not all of them. When I called our insurance company to report my husband's death, they immediately raised my automobile insurance rate. Their agent explained that a single driver is a greater insurance risk than a couple sharing a car. Soon after, I notified our primary credit card issuer. They immediately canceled my credit card. It turned out that Benjamin was the owner and I was merely a user. The bank representative explained that as a user, I was not required to pay any balance owed, but they would take it up with the estate. If I overpaid, I would not get a refund. Since I was the representative of the estate, I paid the bill to the penny. I've since discovered that I'm not the only one who thought there was more time. One widow found herself with a huge and valuable gun collection. It took nearly a year to find the paperwork for each gun, sell it, and deal with the proceeds as part of the estate. Another woman hadn't the heart to ask her sick husband about his beloved sports car. It felt ghoulish, she said. I met a widower who had to untangle his mother-in-law's finances. His wife had always handled that. A neighbor in her late 70s had never written a check in her 50-plus years of marriage. When her husband died, she wasn't even sure which bank they used. My 4 years of widowhood have taught me that grief has no expiration date. It is okay to set your own timetable. I don't have to decide today or tomorrow what to do with Benjamin's coin collection. It doesn't take up much room. There are still surprises that catch me unawares. Our insurance agent sent Benjamin a birthday card recently. He still gets requests to connect on LinkedIn, but not all of the surprises are unhappy ones. A month to the day after Benjamin died, I found an email he wrote to me the night before his brain surgery. In it, he offered advice on what I should keep and what I should sell, friends to consult and advice to ignore. He finished his message with, "Know that you were loved always and mightily." I'll never erase that one. Leslie Milk is the lifestyle editor for the monthly Washingtonian magazine, and she follows her article with 10 steps to help protect a spouse. Couples can ease the burden on tomorrow's survivor by discussing key financial matters today. Here are steps to get your affairs in order. 1. Gather financial papers. Store deeds, passports, insurance policies, estate documents, and the latest statements from financial accounts in a fireproof box at home where survivors can easily find them. 2. Make a must-call list. Compile contact information for your accountant, lawyer, and other financial professionals who need to be contacted when a spouse dies. 3. Share passwords. Keep a master list of all usernames and passwords so your spouse can still have access after your death. 4. Update beneficiaries. Make sure beneficiary designations for your pension, 401k, IRA, brokerage accounts, and life insurance proceeds still reflect your wishes. 5. Check credit cards. Make sure your name is on the credit card account. In most states, when your spouse dies, you won't be responsible for any debt on a card that's not in your name, but you also won't be able to use it and will have to reapply for credit in your own name. 6. Set up advance directives. You both will need health care powers of attorney to designate the person you want to make medical decisions on your behalf if you are incapacitated. You'll also need a living will that spells out what measures you want the doctor to take to prolong your life. 7. Designate a money person. Each of you will need a financial power of attorney so you can name a trusted person to make money decisions for you if you are unable to do so. 8. Review wills and trusts. Do this every few years or when there's a significant change in your life, such as a sizable increase or decrease in your finances. If you don't have a will, get one. 9. Discuss funeral plans. This can save thousands of dollars by letting the surviving spouse, who may need the money, know it's okay not to choose the most expensive funeral. 10. Learn how bills are paid. Keep a list of how bills are paid so the survivor doesn't miss a payment or overdraw an account. Now, still under your money, here's an article, a scam alert, stopping spam calls. Savvy solutions to turn that flood of unsolicited calls seeking to rip you off into a trickle. Unwanted phone calls and text messages continue to surge no matter what efforts lawmakers and regulators take to curb them. In the first 4 months of this year, call blocking service UMail reports more than 12 billion robocalls were made to American homes. That's about 4 million every hour and a steady increase from last year. Live calls from telemarketers have also continued to increase. Why? Sadly, the answer is that they work. It costs scammers and spammers only a few dollars per day to simultaneously blast tens of millions of calls with auto-dialers. Senders, many of them con artists, spend about $438 million per year on robocalls. Those calls generate more than 20 times that amount in income, almost $10 billion a year. The crooks generating the calls easily hide their tracks. Calls may travel through a maze of networks. They often display on caller ID screens with phony, spoofed numbers that may appear to be local or from trusted businesses and government agencies, and they are changed frequently on purpose. It's nothing personal. Spammers often don't know who owns targeted numbers or even if the numbers are active. But no doubt you've been targeted and will continue to be. So, how do you defend yourself? You can try not picking up, but the calls that reach your voicemail greeting could flag that yours is a working number and ripe for future calls. Here is a list of do-it-yourself defenses I use that have dropped the automated and live spam calls received by more than 90%. Answer with silence. When you say hello or anything else, automated voice-activated calls launch the robocall recording or transfer you to a call center where a live operator angles for personal and financial information. But saying nothing usually connects these calls within seconds with no robo-message or callbacks from that phony number. If it is an unsolicited live caller, wait for that person to speak to break the silence. If you don't recognize the voice, hang up. Try a not-in-service recording. Using a portable tape recorder and a microphone attached to a handset, I copied a "this number is not in service" message during a callback to a scammer's spoofed number. Since it's cued, I sometimes play that recording, again saying nothing, when answering calls before they go into voicemail in hopes my number will be removed from spammer calling lists. So far, I have not gotten a single callback from those incoming numbers. Trap them with an app. Smartphone users have plenty of options that flag and block some fraudulent calls and text messages. Some services are free, Others cost a few bucks per month. Customers of AT&T can use Call Protect. Verizon Wireless provides Caller Name ID. Sprint offers Premium Caller ID, and T-Mobile has Scam ID and Scam Block. You can also buy apps like Umail and RoboKiller that will filter calls for a few bucks a month, or for free in the case of Umail. Another freebie for virtually every landline user, press *77 to block anonymous and private numbers, then deactivate it anytime with *87. To block individual numbers that get through on an iPhone, open the phone app, tap the circled eye icon to the right of the spam number that called, scroll down and tap Block This Caller. For Android smartphones, open the phone app and tap the calling number, select Details, then Block Number. Know which calls to avoid. The most common calling cons are pitches that promise to reduce debt and credit card rates or get you pre-approved loans. Offer free or low-cost vacations, timeshares, home security systems, and medical supplies, or come from government and utility company imposters. A dropped or one-ring call is a common ruse to prompt a callback. Beware of area codes 268, 284, 809, and 876, which originate from Caribbean countries with high per-minute phone charges. Robocalls tend to be highest on Friday and Tuesday, and the most targeted numbers are in Atlanta, Chicago, Dallas, New York City, Los Angeles, Houston, Birmingham, Alabama, and Miami. Now, here's another article on the theme of intrusive electronics. This is called How They Track You. Companies and others are regularly gathering information about you, whether you're at the store, in your car, or even at home. This is by Lance Whitney, who has written for Time, CNET, and PC Magazine, and he's also the author of tech books. You can assume that most tasks you perform on a phone or a computer, pay a bill, send a photo, share a joke, or buy a gift, are recorded by some business or organization. But the tracking of your information doesn't end there. Your phone might be silently transmitting your location. Your debit or credit card swipes will mark what you bought and where you bought it. Your alarm system keeps records of when you lock your doors. Most of this is done legally and with good intentions. As companies collect more data about you and your preferences, they presumably can deliver more personalized information and experiences. Some data collection is merely a function of a product itself. A fitness tracker that can't locate you can't record how many miles you ran today, for example. Understanding how your data gets collected can help you take more control of your privacy. Here's a look at situations in daily life in which you may be sharing personal information without realizing it. At home, browsing the internet. That search engine you're using to find websites or information tracks your browsing activity. It then analyzes this behavior to target ads to you. Shopping online. Amazon and other online retailers have made it an art form to track not only your purchasing patterns, but also what items you viewed so they can recommend more products that align with your interests and needs. Listening to music. When you activate an Amazon Echo or Google Home speaker by voice, those companies record what you utter. Doc Searles, editor-in-chief at Linux Journal, calls smart speakers a personal data fire hose squirting from your house. Watching TV. Some smart TVs can collect your viewing data and other information. New models typically ask your permission first, but it's not always easy to understand what you're agreeing to. If you have an older set, it may be tracking you by default. You'd have to opt out. Cooking a meal. Many new models of kitchen appliances, thermostats, light bulbs, light switches, door locks, and more can be controlled from a phone or remote device. The fact that everyday household products are now connected to the internet presents new privacy and data security challenges, says Sam Lester, consumer privacy fellow for the Electronic Privacy Information Center. transmitted data can indicate whether you are home. And then there's when you're doing business. If you're getting your computer fixed, got a problem with your computer, the repair team at that big box store can help. But recent reports revealed that employees at Best Buy were paid by the FBI to notify them of possible illegal content on customers' computers. Shopping at a store. Those cards that get you discounts at stores and restaurants and other businesses are used to track your name and address and what you buy. Surfing the web at a coffee house. Beware of eavesdroppers on free Wi-Fi networks. The person next to you could be using a tool called a packet sniffer to see what data you're sending to the website you visit, says Ray Klump, professor and chair of computer science and mathematics at Lewis University. Visiting your doctor. Pacemakers, defibrillators, and other medical devices are now often connected to your doctor or hospital, transmitting medical information. Researching your genealogy. Businesses like 23andMe and Ancestry.com promise to reveal your genetic relatives based on the DNA from a saliva sample. But who's able to peek at that data? Recent criminal cases reveal that police are working with such services to gather information for investigations. And finally, out and about. Driving. EasyPass and other toll transponders create a log of your locations. Also, speed or red light cameras at key locations snap license plate numbers along with the date, time, and location. And some auto insurance companies may want to track your driving with the device installed in your car that transmits data. Renting a car. Connecting your phone to the onboard electronics in a rental car could be risky. Anyone who uses the car afterward may be able to go through the car's menus and see what calls you made, and they may even be able to find out your contact list, Klump says. Doing research at the library. If you go to the library and use a public internet kiosk there and forget to log out, the data you saved and the websites you visited will be available to the next person, Klump says. Browsers offer a setting through which you can clear your history, logins, and other info. Exercising. The fitness tracker on your wrist collects data on your workouts, exercise routines, and location. That information is shared with the manufacturers and can be synced with your social media accounts. Taking a walk. Your phone's location service tracks you and may share that data with certain apps, says Jeff Wilbur, technical director of the Online Trust Alliance. We love the benefits of our smartphones as GPS or to utilize ride sharing or similar location-based services, but by default, these apps track and log a tremendous amount about your location history. Also, surveillance cameras are increasingly used in public places to aid police investigations or to monitor for suspicious activity. So, how to protect yourself against this? Use a VPN. Virtual private networks are secure data tunnels that protect online activity from prying eyes. Search VPN on the web to find services. Most charge a small monthly fee. Change web browsers. A few, like Tor or Epic Privacy Browser, prevent snoopers from seeing the sites you visit and stop websites from tracking you. Search anonymously. Search engines such as DuckDuckGo and StartPage block ad trackers and keep your search history private. Be wary when using apps. Many ask for access to your contacts, photos, and other information. Decline first and see how the app runs without sharing that info. Don't share your location. If you go for a walk that your fitness app tracked, don't post your path on Facebook, even for bragging rights, because then people see very clearly where you live and when you're away, says Ray Klump, professor of computer science and mathematics at Lewis University. And now to more encouraging topics. Here under your life is an article, I Never Lost Sight of My Musical Dreams. 5 years after sudden vision loss, classical violinist Alison Dalton plays on by using technology. In September 2013, I sat down to play the first rehearsal of my 27th season with the Chicago Symphony Orchestra. Minutes later, I couldn't read my music because of a whiteout in my vision. I was a violinist at the top of my game, and at 53 was also fiercely independent, a cancer survivor, and single mom of five. I went home not knowing if I would ever be back, and there I stayed, practically imprisoned at home, disabled without my full income, even with the CSO's excellent benefits. I had kids in college. The doctors had no explanation, and the whiteout was getting bigger. It was then that I received a summons from my maestro, Ricardo Muti. Leaning back on his sofa, he said, "I am your friend. Tell me what's happening." It was the first of many encounters in which he encouraged me to stay strong. "Do what it takes to come back," he assured me. He inspired me to find a way forward when no cutting-edge doctor had. Our healthcare system provides no advocacy for patients with rare diseases. With my violin student and friend, Professor Joy Bergelson, a prominent biologist at the University of Chicago, we set out to find answers. 53 specialists at 26 hospitals in five countries and hundreds of pages of medical records later, I finally got a diagnosis at Massachusetts General Hospital. Bullseye maculopathy. The cones in the center of my retina, crucial for high acuity vision, were dying. It's incurable. Working with the Chicago Lighthouse for the Blind, we determined a 400% computer enlargement would enable me to read music on stage. I'm so tech-averse, I would rather have taught a seeing-eye dog to read my music. And unfortunately, there was no existing software that could handle the complexity needed to copy music. So Joy and her computer whiz daughter, Allie, a cellist and pre-med student, worked up a solution with software designed for other uses. The CSO librarian scanned my music and handled the copyrights. My son Graham, a physics major and hornist, became my copyist. The usual page of music has 12 lines. He needed to convert 3 lines at a time to be displayed on my 27-inch screen. In the middle of all this, I remarried. My husband Charles, a negotiation specialist, helped navigate the Americans with Disabilities Act to get me professional accommodation. I spent months rehearsing with the orchestra. Using an audio-visual feed from the stage, I practiced in a separate room, learning my second instrument, the computer. The process was a drama of clunk, crash, cry. I returned to the Chicago Symphony stage in the summer of 2015. It was a roller coaster. The foot pedal to turn the pages began to slide away. During one performance, the computer screen cracked during a cannon shot in Tchaikovsky's 1812 overture. In Beijing, the computer overheated and froze on the title page of Prokofiev's First Symphony. I played the entire symphony from memory. But I've come a long way. I'm still playing, both on tour and for Chicago audiences. At the end of one concert, John Williams came to me backstage and said, "How did it go?" I said, "Don't let anybody tell you your violin parts are tough. I just played them blind." And that's it for today. But I hope you'll listen next time to Modern Maturity. I'm Florence Nash, reading the Triangle Radio Reading Service, and I'm generously underwritten by Celebi Chiropractic, which welcomes the geriatric community with any neck, back, or hip issues. Call them at 919-782-4733. The content of this program is for people who are blind and print impaired, and this broadcast will be readily available as a podcast at our website, trianglereadingservice.org. So long until next time.